I'm Benjamin Powell. I'm an assistant professor of economics at Suffolk University and a research fellow at the Independent Institute. Formerly, I directed our Center on Entrepreneurial Innovation at the Independent Institute, which is what got this book project going, to produce a book not accidentally titled something like tonight's event, Making Poor Nations Rich. I should say a little something about the title. I didn't give the book that title. And when I first saw it, I actually wasn't a huge fan of it because I think there's very little, quote, we in the West can do to, quote, make somebody rich. It has to come from within the own country, really. The working title, which typically from an academic sounded a little too academic, is now the subtitle, Entrepreneurship and the Process of Development, which is what actually makes a poor nation rich. And we'll get into that a little bit more tonight as the program goes on. The reason for creating the book, really, was the interest that really started to pick up in promoting third world development, whether we're looking at rock stars and pop culture like Bono, politicians like Tony Blair, or more recently Barack Obama, and looking at big plans for the rest of the world and doubling aid to impoverished areas, particularly concentrating on Africa, whether these are the Millennium Development Goals from the United Nations or proposals from here in the United States. It seemed that often these programs placed the focus really on things that P.T. Bauer called the consequences of economic development, not the causes, often focusing on putting in aid for investment, aid for education, things that come about as a country is developing. So to remedy that and try to push the policy debate a little bit more in the other direction, we put this book together to really focus on the role that entrepreneurs play in the process of development and how they respond to institutional environments. Because if anybody here has traveled to other parts of the world, you know entrepreneurs are all over the place. It's not that countries don't have them. It's a question of how productive they are at promoting economic growth in these places. Often it's barriers that prevent their businesses from expanding. But even worse, often it's poor institutional environments that channel their efforts into ways that aren't socially productive. Adam Smith's invisible hand was institutionally contingent on the area of voluntary exchange. That's what you get the societal benefits from people pursuing their own self-interest. All too often, the way entrepreneurs get ahead in other areas of the world, and even here in the United States and this city in particular, Washington, D.C., the focus is on getting somebody else's money transferred to you. Competing in that manner isn't socially beneficial. It's socially wasteful. It's effort that could have gone to making other people better off. Sometimes it's even worse than that. It's socially destructive. And that's when you compete to get barriers thrown in the way of your competitors. And in the process, you might get ahead, but you hold the rest of society back. So what this book does is it focuses on how entrepreneurs switch between these roles in looking at the different institutional environments around the world and trying to focus on how, by respecting private property rights better, granting greater degrees of economic freedom, respecting the rule of law, that we can channel more entrepreneurial effort into the socially productive form. So what this book does is we begin by explaining kind of this economic and institutional background to it and how entrepreneurs cause growth. And then Bob Lawson provides a chapter surveying the role of economic freedom in promoting prosperity around the world. And from there, we move to really the meat of the book, which is a bunch of case studies from around the world. We study 9 different countries. We have 12 authors coming from 6 different countries, all who are experts in the area that they're writing about. And luckily, we have 2 of them here with us tonight, Professor George Aidi and Alvaro Vargas Llosa, who both wrote chapters for the book and will be talking as well as I will. How we'll proceed is I'll start by introducing one of them. They will give their talk, and after both of them spoke, I'll kind of wrap up with a little bit more of a success story, talking about Ireland and then some of the bigger lessons from the book, and then we'll have Q&A at the end. They are recording tonight, so I ask you please to turn your cell phones off if you have not already. Our first speaker tonight is Alvaro Vargas Llosa. He's a senior fellow and the director of the Center on Global Prosperity here at the Independent Institute. He's also a nationally syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group and the author of the book Liberty for Latin America, which obtained the Sir Anthony Fisher Memorial Award for its contribution to the cause of freedom in 2005. He was also recently appointed a young global leader in 2007 by the World Economic Forum in Davos. He is a native of Peru and received his bachelor's degree in international history and his MA from the London School of Economics. He's been a member of the board for the Miami Herald Publishing Company and an op-ed page editor and columnist there. He's contributed to numerous newspapers around the country and the world. He's the author of The Che Guevara Myth, Liberty for Latin America, The Madness of Things Peruvian, and The Guide to the Perfect Latin American Idiot. Please join me in welcoming Alvaro Vargas Llosa.
I wouldn't want you to get the wrong idea from those titles. They're just meant to grab some attention. Thank you very much, Ben. That was a very kind introduction. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you so much for coming to share some ideas and thoughts with us about development issues. I'm going to talk a little bit about Latin America. It's not going to be as bleak a picture as you might expect. Some things are going, I think, well, or at least are going in the right direction. But in general, it's not going to be the most upbeat talk you've ever heard. But that's, of course, always done in the spirit of trying to persuade those who make decisions that things can be better and that we can move in the right direction. And if we do, of course, we can achieve glory very quickly. That's one of the wonderful things about the world today. If you look at Latin America in general, the perception is that there has been a tilt to the left. There's been a sort of move to the, in some cases, the soft left, in other cases, to the hard left, but in general, a move to the left, a radicalization of Latin American politics and a rebirth of some of these old leftist ideas and instincts. I have a slightly different take. I think what's going on is basically a struggle, a cultural struggle. It's also an institutional struggle, but foremost a cultural struggle between what I call modernizers and reactionaries. The modernizers are a very mixed bunch. You have people on the center right, like the Mexican president, the Colombian president, the Salvadorian president, and you have what I like to call the vegetarian left, the Lulas from Brazil or the Vasquezes from Uruguay or the Alan Garcias even from Peru, people who are on the sort of left wing of politics but who have adapted to the circumstances, to the world around them. So we call them vegetarian. They are softies. They're pretty innocuous. They're not that dangerous anymore. And then we have the reactionaries. That's basically the carnivorous left. We used to have a carnivorous right. It doesn't exist anymore. I'm sure it'll come back at some point. We have this tendency for these movements to come back. But we have a carnivorous left. The Chavezes in Venezuela, the Moraleses in Bolivia, the Correas in Ecuador, the Ortegas perhaps in Nicaragua, and so on and so forth. So we have the modernizers and we have the reactionaries. What do the modernizers want? Apparently, they want the market economy, globalization, and democracy, political democracy. What do the reactionaries want? Basically populism, in economic terms, isolationism, or to put it more, I think, more precisely, a confrontation with the dominant powers in this world. But they're not really isolationist all the way because they like to team up with themselves and with other radicals around the world. So they believe in confrontation with the main centers of power around the world, with liberal democracies, so to speak. And this confrontation, I think, is extremely important because it's dominating Latin American politics and the economy. And it's, in many ways, determining our present and our near future. Why? Well, because when modernizers get a breakthrough, like they did in the 90s, for instance, what you tend to have is something that holds them back. They don't quite dare go far enough. They don't go deep enough and far enough in terms of economic reform. The market in which they apparently believe in, globalization in which they apparently believe in, and political democracy in which they apparently believe in. When the carnivores turn into vegetarians, we've had a few examples. Many of the people I just mentioned in Brazil and Uruguay and Peru used to be carnivores. Lula's background in Brazil is that of a Marxist unionist. Alan Garcia, I was in Peru in my native country in the 1980s. Alan Garcia was a carnivore. He was the Chavez of the time. There wasn't that much oil around, but apart from the oil aspect, everything else was very much like Chavez, including the rhetoric. He's now turned into a vegetarian. But because of this cultural struggle, he's turned into only a vegetarian. He hasn't gone far enough in terms of political and economic reform. He's content with managing the status quo, with holding back the carnivores that are trying to take power away from him and influence the course of events. But again, this dynamic, I think, is holding back Latin America from catching up with Eastern and Central Europe, India, China, other reforming countries. In the case of China, obviously leaving politics aside and just concentrating on economics. The carnivores, I think, are important because they're influential, and there is a mixed constituency there that's in a way supporting those carnivores. And I think it's important to understand where they're coming from and what they want, what their aspirations are. We have people who are disillusioned with the 1990s. We went through a period of economic reform, apparently free market reform in the 1990s. Many people are disillusioned with what happened there. They think there was a lot of corruption. There were too many private monopolies emerging from that process of reform, from that wave of reform. There are people who are looking for a cultural identity, and I think that identity needs to be collectively expressed. And in many cases, ethnically expressed. And that probably is an important factor in Bolivia and some of the other Andean countries. There are people who are rent seekers, rent seekers that have been around forever and suddenly realize that the populist state is more in tune with rent seekers than the free market state. I'm just trying to illustrate how it's a very mixed constituency. People are coming from very different backgrounds and very different illusions and aspirations. But this is an important base. Otherwise, Chavez wouldn't be there, Morales wouldn't be there, Correa wouldn't be there, Ortega wouldn't be there. We wouldn't have had Humala in my country, my native country in Peru, with 48% in the last presidential election. He didn't quite win, but he was, he got very close to victory. So this is important to understand. It's a very fascinating and at the same time, of course, very dangerous dynamic. The carnivores versus the vegetarians, the modernizers versus the reactionaries. Now, I think it's very important to take into account the background to all of this. Where is this coming from? What is behind this? Why is this state of affairs what it is today? Well, there's one word to describe what happened before and what led to this state of affairs, and that's populism. The 20th century in Latin America is the century of populism. Populism was, and this is a word that has different connotations in different parts of the world, including the United States, where in many cases it has a positive connotation. When I talk about populism, I hear a lot of American friends say to me, but populism is a good thing. We have Jeffersonian populism. Populism is a bottom-up process of participation, economically and politically. Yes, but not in Latin America. In Latin America, populism means exactly the opposite. Populism emerged as a reaction against the 19th century oligarchic state. And it was an oligarchy. This is not a Marxist invention. Yes, the 19th century was deeply, profoundly oligarchic in Latin America. And it generated this reaction, which was a populist reaction. We had these caudillos, as we call them. Caudillos is a Spanish word meaning strong. There's not an exact translation, but it means basically strong men. And it was always men, not women, strong men, who wanted to do basically three things. One was to generate this mythical idea that there was a wealth that somebody took away from us, foreign powers, imperialists, foreign capitalists. There was this mythical wealth that we possessed at one point in our history. This is a very powerful idea that populism has in many cases ingrained in our psyche. The idea of redemption, almost a theological idea. The idea was not to redeem the soul. The idea was to redeem the poor in Latin America. These caudillos ingrained in our mind the idea that the state was going to be a great redeemer of the poor. A very powerful idea if you were a Latin American poor and you felt that the state was an oligarchic state, that the society was a two-tier society in which the state was basically supporting a group of interests that were alien to your aspirations. And the other idea was the idea of wealth redistribution. In other words, wealth was not something that had to be generated constantly. It was something that was already there, so somebody took away from you, and that once you recover it, simply needs to be redistributed in order to create social justice. A very powerful set of ideas, very simple, very wrong, very flawed, but extremely powerful. And this is populism. Populism had some very interesting characteristics. I've always asked myself, how would I define populism? And I love to start by recalling a famous quote by somebody, an American writer I absolutely admire from the first half of the 20th century, H.L. Mencken, who said a demagogue is somebody who preaches ideas he knows to be untrue to people he knows to be idiots. How would we define populism? Well, maybe a populist is somebody who wants to abolish an individual right in the name of all the rights, knowing that all the rights are the same as none, because it is the state, not the individual, who embodies these rights. And he also knows that populism concentrates the benefits on a small group of people who feel these tangible benefits, and of course, generates costs that are dispersed throughout society. In other words, nobody realizes they're actually paying the cost of populism. It's a very perverse system. You feel the tangible benefits of populism. Nobody else feels the tangible costs or intangible costs of populism. And it's a very perverse system. So that kind of dominated the 20th century. It had a very important economic dimension, which is something we could call with different names. I tend to call it economic nationalism, which is what dominated, I think, the landscape, the economic and political landscape from the 30s to the end of the 80s, economic nationalism. It was based on the idea that there were unjust terms of trade between Latin America and the rest of and the rich countries, between the periphery countries, as we called Latin America back then, and the center countries, as the rich countries, mainly the United States and Europe, were called. The idea was that periphery countries were selling cheap primary products and raw materials to the center countries that were selling back to Latin America and other underdeveloped countries very expensive manufactured goods. So there was this imbalance. And because the rich countries monopolized technology and capital, it was impossible for Latin America to generate development because it simply didn't generate enough foreign exchange because of this imbalance to import that capital and that technology. So this whole thing was a form of exploitation by the rich countries. So we came up with structuralism and dependency theory and all these sophisticated names to justify what? Basically statist policies, interventionist policies, tariffs, quotas, nationalizations, industrial policies, all different forms of concentrating power in the state, generating more and more political discretion on the part of those who took decisions, made decisions in society, and sucking away resources from the individual in Latin America. Just to give you an example, the consequence of this was, of course, that instead of accumulating capital, as other countries around the world, and some of them are featured in this important book, we were consuming capital. We were destroying, annihilating capital. In the 1980s alone, capital flight from Latin America amounted to about four times all the foreign aid distributed by multilateral bodies like the IMF to the entire underdeveloped world, not just to Latin America, about $250 billion. So just think of that. I mean, this was a huge process of consumption of capital. So obviously, this didn't bode well for Latin America's future and destiny. And what happened was a huge crisis. And this crisis took place at the end of the 80s, early 90s, depending on what country you're talking about. But it was a huge crisis. And as all crises, it generated great tension within the statist system. And you had a very interesting division between those who wanted to nationalize the entire economy. They said, we just haven't gone far enough in this statist process. We need to take over all means of production. And the protectionists, who wanted the government to protect them, who believed deeply and profoundly in government intervention, but of course didn't believe in the government taking their property away from them, they were, after all, private entrepreneurs who wanted to keep their, you know, the ownership of their assets. And this fascinating tension within the statist system opened the way to what? To free market reform. And that's what happened in the 1990s. Except that what happened was flawed free market reform, a type of free market reform that I think didn't go as far as it should have, as it could have, as far as some countries in Central Europe and in Eastern Europe and in Southern Europe went, or countries like New Zealand, or countries maybe at least in economic terms like India and China today. And so we have a very mixed result in the 1990s, pretty much a loss of a great opportunity. Yes, there was price controls were lifted, capital controls were lifted, a lot of companies were privatized, many of those tariffs went down. But we ended up replacing all of that with new forms of government intervention. Inflation was replaced with new taxes. Tariffs were replaced with trading blocks, regional or sub-regional trading blocks. Of course, government monopolies were replaced with private monopolies. So in the end, you have a very mixed type of reform, which is free market on the one hand, status on the other hand, a very contradictory type of reform that I think didn't quite replace the system that was very much the legacy of the 20th century, the populist legacy of the 20th century. So what was the result of this? The result of this was growth was tiny, about 1% for that decade. The size of government was not reduced. In Argentina, the GDP, the size of the economy went up, grew by about 40% in the 90s, which is not bad. But the size of government measured by the public spending, you can measure it in many other ways, went up by 100%, 2.5 times more than the growth of the economy. In the last 30 years, every Latin American country except Chile has seen its GDP per capita drop as a proportion of the U.S. Per capita GDP. Whereas Thailand's and Indonesia's two middle-of-the-table countries in Asia have seen theirs rise by 40%. The average growth in Latin America at that period was about 3%. The average growth in the world was 3.3%. In Southeast Asia, it was 7.7%. So the performance was clearly not good enough. So this is the background to the situation. I only have 2 minutes. I have to speed things up a little bit, but this is the background. Let me come back to the present day Latin America. We're going through. We have this. I talked at the beginning about this cultural struggle. We're in a very interesting and deceiving type of situation. We're going through a bonanza, a boom in Latin America, a commodities led boom, an export led boom. We've had many of these in the past, in the 1920s, in the 1950s. In the 1970s. We've been through this so many times before. So Latin America has been growing at an average rate of 4% annually for the last half decade. Foreign investment has totaled about the equivalent of 2% of the region's GDP in the last half decade. All of this has generated some government revenue. The government in every Latin American country is spending this revenue on, of course, social programs to try and reduce poverty. These programs usually entail cash stipends to the poor in exchange for a commitment on the part of those families to take those kids to school and have them vaccinated. In Brazil, you have Bolsa Familia, which is one of the many programs around, about 12 million households are getting these cash handouts. The program called Oportunidades in Mexico, about the same, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of revenue because of these exports tied to natural resources. Is this sustainable? I don't think so. In the long run, I don't think so. In the last 3 years, the region's GDP in total has gone up, the accumulated GDP has gone up by about 53%. Productivity has gone up by only 4%. This huge disparity, I think, tells the story. We're being dragged along by this world bonanza, mostly, I think, led by the insatiable demand on the part of the Chinese and to some degree by other Asian countries. But this is not really the result of a huge torrent of entrepreneurial activity in Latin America. And I think, and this I will finish with this, I think this is what we need. And maybe in the question and answer period I can go into this with more detail. I think we need to remove a lot of barriers to entrepreneurship in Latin America. What we have today is a labyrinthine system that makes it very costly to participate in various markets in Latin America, that makes it extremely difficult to be competitive. It makes it very hard to even be legal in Latin America. So what you have is a lot of entrepreneurship that is simply going to be wasted, that is not being productive. You have in Peru about 3 million small and mid-sized companies that only generate about 30% of the country's GDP. It's very unproductive when you have 98% of the country's businesses generating only 30% of the wealth. Only 2% of the country's businesses are generating 70% of the wealth. Why? Because we have too many taxes, too many regulations, a judiciary that is simply not trustworthy. It is totally dependent on the political process, et cetera, et cetera. We have a labor market that is entirely riddled with interventionist policies. In Argentina, we have a fascinating situation in which Mussolini's labor code that was imported into Argentina by Perón half a century ago is still there. So if you want to operate in the labor market in Argentina, you're subject to Mussolini's rules. If you talk about trade in Latin America, you have all these, I mentioned these sub-regional trading blocks. I mean, Latin America, South American integration is basically a patchwork of competing sub-regional trading blocks, all of which, of course, liberate trade among a few countries and just generate a lot of tariffs to the rest of the region and the area. Very little innovation because the government, again, makes it very difficult to innovate. If you're in Mexico, you're a small business in the pharmaceutical industry, you have to sell your products very cheaply to the government toward a social security program that involves healthcare. And, of course, you have very little capital left for research and development, only about 0.4% of the country's GDP is destined to that. Again, a lot of public spending, which is going up in the area as a whole about 10% every year, crowding out private activity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I will probably go into this in more detail in the question and answer period. But what we have is a situation in which, because of this populist background, this cultural struggle, in other words, we have not determined what kind of society we want, we're being held back from genuine reform. And I think that kind of reform basically means eliminating all these barriers to trade and to labor mobility and to investment and basically to entrepreneurial activity. And that's what has made other countries, as this book, I think, illustrates very profoundly, rich. So I don't want to, you know, finish with a bleak message. This is a very positive message. It can be done. Yes, we can. Sí se puede. But we need to engage in reform. We need to be bold. We need to be daring. We need to shed these legacies, and I think we can do it if we follow the example of some of these countries that, as Ben will tell you at the end, have been extremely successful at creating and generating wealth in a very short period of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alvin.